Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am very happy today to be speaking to Nell McShane Wolfhart. She's a travel journalist living in Montevideo, Uruguay. And she is has been a longtime New York Times columnist, including the column Carry On from 2016 to 2019. Her writings appeared in many places, including Travel and Leisure, Bon Appetit, Condé Nast, Traveler, The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian. She's the author of an Audible original book called Off Menu. And we're here to talk about her brand new book, literally just off the presses. In fact, I literally picked up my official copy about 5 minutes before this podcast was recorded. The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. Nell, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Eric. I'm happy to be here.
Could you start by giving us just kind of an overview of the book and why you started as a food writer and a travel writer, why you moved to talking about these workers?
Well, I think every journalist is sort of has the idea of writing a book in the back of their mind. And I definitely was tossing around ideas for at least a full decade before I came across this one. And it just sort of like ticked all the boxes for me. It's about feminism. It's about the labor movement. And it's about stewardesses. And I think everyone loves a stewardess. So it really sort of captured my imagination. And when I dove into it a little more, the idea that what we think of as the golden age of travel, like Don Draper and cocktails on the plane and roast beef in first class and cigarettes and, you know, impossibly glamorous stewardesses. It turned out it sort of had this dark side, which was that the working conditions for the stewardesses were something like, were just appalling. It was like the most sexist workplace in America. And as I dove into the story, I found out about the women who changed all that through what I like to call the Great Stewardess Rebellion.
Can you talk a little more? I mean, we may have a sense of the outlines of this, you know, just from watching Mad Men or whatever, certainly. But can you talk about just how horribly sexist this workplace was?
It was a real surprise to me to learn about this, but it was the sort of place where no one ever considered being a stewardess, at least until the late 1960s. It was never going to be a career because you could only become a stewardess until you got married or you got pregnant or you turned 32. Once any of those things happened, you were fired. So the idea was that it was basically just sort of an interlude between high school and college and getting married. And that was what most women knew they were signing up for. It was really just a job, just sort of a stopping place. It was sold as a very glamorous job, you know, travel, see the world, be independent, do all these things, but only for a few short years and only, you know, until you were fired for those reasons. And there was a lot of restrictions on the way the women had to look that sort of kept the glamorous image alive. But those things were like very stringent weight restrictions. There were weight charts, there were weight limits you had to meet. You would be put on a scale before a flight. And if you're a few pounds overweight, you could be pulled off the flight. You couldn't wear glasses. You had to have straight teeth. No scars. That was industry one. Girdles were a big one. That was one of the things I learned about. Any supervisor could sort of give you like a flick on the butt to make sure that you're wearing your girdle.
You know, and I think one of the things that really comes across in this book is like the very physical nature of this harassment, like the touching, the lack of a bodily autonomy for these workers.
Very much so. And that was really the fault of the airlines, because the way that they turned the stewardesses into sort of marketing devices. They produced ads that featured the stewardesses, like the faces in like very close up, always smiling. Smiling was a big part of the job. And they kind of sold tickets based on how beautiful or sexy their stewardesses were. And then in the 70s, you get into some really interesting uniforms, hot pants and go-go boots. That was a uniform for Southwest, which is horrifying. Mini skirts, lots of things. So they were really almost like inviting passengers and telling passengers, their target passengers were male business travelers, which I think is probably still true today. But that it was like, that's what the women were there for. They were there to be stared at. They were there maybe to be groped. Some airlines for a while had a requirement that the stewardesses had to kiss the passengers when they were getting off the plane.
Yeah. I mean, you have this amazing photo toward the end of the book of this obviously horrified Stewart is being kissed fully on the lips by this creepy old man. And it just says so much about the ways in which this workplace actually operated.
Yeah, it's really incredible. They basically were, you know, they were essential. They had to be on the plane for safety reasons. And flight attendants for decades have been campaigning to be licensed as safety professionals. For that reason, like, they weren't being taken seriously by the passengers. They weren't being taken seriously by the pilots. They just kind of viewed them as like cocktail waitresses in the sky.
So, you know, now we kind of laid this out. I mean, you really focus this on a couple of women. And I have to say that, you know, I know a decent amount about flight attendant unionism, but I really didn't know these stories at all. And so I really appreciated it. And I was wondering if you could sort of talk about a couple of the women that you really focused on here.
Absolutely. Yeah, flight attendants have been unionized since there have been flight attendants at almost every airline. I think Delta is the glaring exception, and we can talk about that later if you want. But my main characters are two women. One of them is called Pat Gibbs. She became a stewardess at American Airlines in 1962. And she was like a small town girl. Her family life had been kind of unsettled, and her crowning ambition in life was to become a supervisor at American Airlines. Or a manager. And over the years, as she worked and she started to see how unfair the working conditions were, you know, women being fired for being a few pounds over the weight limit or being fired for getting pregnant, you know, by accident, things like this, all these started to build up. They're really taking charge, getting involved in the union and fighting for this like huge change to get rid of all of these rules, marriage, pregnancy, you know, age, lots of restrictions, even like uniform restrictions, high heels, nail polish, all of these things. And she does that, through the students' union. And then sort of her counterpart is Tommy Hutto Blake. Both of these women only stopped flying in the last like 10 or 20 years, by the way. And Tommy she came on a little later, about 10 years later. She was from Texas and she became a stewardess. Just think, okay, I'm going to fly for a few years, have some fun. Maybe I'll go out to California. She ended up flying for more than 40 years. And she was also realized that in order to have any power at all, to make any kind of change in the job, to get out of these tiny uniforms and to get out from under the groping hands of the passengers, that she was going to have to run for office in the union. And she did that. And they sort of work, they're sort of friends and enemies. There's quite a lot of drama, but they're both became eventual presidents of their own independent union.
And, you know, that's a big piece of this story, right, is this complex relationship that these women have with unions, right? I mean, you know, the precursor to the contemporary American Flight Association, some flight attendants, you know, comes out of these, as you know, these late 40s unions, and there's so many issues with the other unions that they deal with, the pilots and especially, right? And all of these people who are also theoretically labor people, not really taking them seriously, right? That this is, there's an entire world of men not taking these women seriously. So that's a big piece of your book, is sort of, you know, this kind of this union story. And could you sort of expand on that a little bit?
You're exactly right. That basically they were considered kind of the mascots of the labor movement. And the flight attendants were in union. I mostly talk about American Airlines flight attendants in my book, but there's, you know, this is generally applicable to other flight attendants of the time. They were affiliated to the Transport Workers Union. And the Transport Workers Union at that time, like in the 60s and 70s, it really was run by, you know, former subway workers and bus drivers and kind of exactly the sort of people that one might think of when you say, oh, union leader, you know, a lot of older white men. And their wives didn't work outside the home. They were pretty traditional and they were not interested in fighting for, you know, the things the flight attendants wanted, like single rooms on layovers. That became a huge issue. So the flight attendants were essentially fighting a battle on both fronts. They weren't just fighting the company to get rid of all these sexist rules and regulations. They were also fighting with the people who were supposed to be representing them, these men at the TWU, who were supposed to be fighting for their rights at the bargaining table, but they never sort of took on board the issues the stewardesses wanted them to fight for. It was a real conflict.
So how did these stewardesses, how did they make an adjustment there? How did they, you know, continue their fight within the union?
This is a bit of a spoiler alert, but they eventually left the union. And this is sort of the story as I go throughout the book of Pat and Tommy and their conflict, and that Tommy wanted to stay within the transport workers union. She wanted to fight for a seat at the table. She thought, like, this is the only way we're really going to get power is by staying within this traditional labor structure. While Pat and a bunch of other flight attendants, they essentially went rogue. They thought the TWU is never going to represent our interests. These men are not going to fight for us. They're going all out for the mechanics, for the ground crew, for the cleaners, but they don't care about the flight attendants. And so they decide to hold an election to leave the transport workers and start their own independent union. And that's kind of the end of the book. That battle takes place over the course of a year. And eventually American Airlines flight attendants, along with like 14,000 flight attendants, depart the TWU and they start their own independent women-led unions.
Does TWU represent any flight attendants today?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so that's totally gone.
Yeah, yeah. It was a big loss for them, you know, not only dues, but also there were almost no women left in the transport workers union after they lost all the flight attendants.
I mean, going back a little bit, one of the kind of great stories in the book is when Pat Gibbs tells off Jimmy Hoffa, you know, or like stands up to him. I mean, you know, and then to me it's sort of, I guess, you know, telling about how these women, these leaders anyway, were really did not have patience for any men that they saw as representing this sexist patriarchy they were fighting against every day. And, you know, I don't know if you want to tell that story or talk a little bit about that kind of that incident.
Sure. This was back in the 60s and the Teamsters had been making a lot of overtures to flight attendants. They wanted to organize the flight attendants. And Pat Gibbs, before she's a union rep at this point, and she's attending a Congress in Chicago. And she's sort of brought unwittingly to a meeting with Jimmy Hoffa because some other stewardesses had been, you know, they felt that the TWU wasn't representing the interests and they thought about leaving and going with the Teamsters. And so they bring Pat to this meeting and she walks in and sees Jimmy Hoffa. And she essentially flips out and she starts yelling at him. She says, I don't want to be a Teamster. I never wanted to be a Teamster. You guys are, you know, crowbar wielding, tire chain wielding thugs. And she storms out. And Jimmy, in the way Pat told me, she says, Jimmy Hoffa's like, well, we're not that bad. What Pat told me a couple of years ago when I was interviewing her for this book, she said that if she had known then how much it was going to take to get equal rights for women in the airplane cabin, she would have joined the Teamsters in a heartbeat and she would have adopted some of those tactics that she had attributed to them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's, you know, kind of thinking about that trajectory, right? How is it that these women, you know, they start and they're pretty, you know, union activists from a, you know, at the beginning of their careers, you know, fairly early in this kind of service worker, if we want to call them that, being organized. And, you know, this kind of trajectory where they sort of gain this, you know, savvy and this understanding of how change is going to have to be made, you know, so that they, you know, initially, again, like reject the Teamsters, but then those tactics seem a lot more appealing later. I mean, I guess, you know, how is the story also a story of the growth of women in the labor movement and the increasing sophistication of tactics to fight for workplace justice during this era?
Well, I think it's interesting because flight attendants, like I said, they have always been organized, or almost all flight attendants have been organized. So they've been there as part of the labor movement, but they were either represented by pilots or they were represented by other organizations that sort of like overshadowed them or, you know, took away their vote and gave them less control. And I actually think that as I tell in my book, it was the impact of the women's movement that sort of woke them up a little bit to some of the injustices that they were suffering and to make them realize that they could make real change. You know, Gloria Steinem is also in the book. She was a huge supporter of flight attendants and she really helped them, you know, get organized and get the word out and, you know, protest sexist ads and do all of these things. It's basically the awareness that the feminist movement could do some things for them, but that in the industry they were working in, they had to have a seat at the bargaining table. They just realized that like that was where the power was. They needed to be there doing the negotiating. They need to be the ones talking face to face with the company. And yeah, they went from being sort of passive, you know, union members to like really militant labor leaders.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think one of the, you know, I don't know, irony is the right word here, but one of the realities, I guess, that they're facing is that, you know, they're increasingly influenced by feminism. Again, Steinem, as you point out, is a huge supporter. And you know, I mean, a lot of these, you know, one of the stories I think that a lot of us feel is for those of us who, for professional reasons or whatever, end up traveling a lot, you know, you get this really, you know, sympathy with these workers, especially when you see, you know, the terrible behavior that some people have on, you know, while they're flying, and watching their sort of professional responses, right? And so you have this rising feminism, this really support from powerful feminist leaders, and yet, you know, not only do they not have a kind of power at work, which is common for women, you know, women in the steel industry are fighting against the same sorts of things in the 70s, very not glamorous, but these women are fighting against a patriarchy that is explicitly sexualizing them, right? That is forcing them into these outfits. That the core issues of the 70s era of the feminist movement are their lives, right? And so I guess, you know, to me, one of the big stories here is the ways in which this becomes not only a labor story, but very much a specific kind of labor feminism. And I was wondering if you would expand on that a little bit.
Well, I think it's really interesting because the kind of behavior that we associate with like militant unionists and the kind of behavior we associate with flight attendants could not be more different. And one of the organizations that was founded in the 70s was a group of stewardesses, and they called it Stewardesses for Women's Rights, which I think is just the most perfect 1970s name ever. It's just like so evocative. And they got together in a, you know, a basement in the village with Gloria Steinem, and they plotted out ways that they could change the things in their workplace that were bothering them. And I just love this like juxtaposition of them, you know, in the 70s, long hair, bell bottoms, no makeup, sitting in a talking circle, chatting with Gloria Steinem about women's rights. And then they go back to their apartment and they put on their tiny uniforms and they put their hair back and pin it up, and they have to go onto the airplane and be like, oh, more coffee, Mr. So-and-so. It was just becoming increasingly difficult to put up with the sexualization of them by the company, by the ad. I mean, some of the ads, I put a lot of them in the book, and they are, I mean, hilarious in a horrifying way, I guess, the way they were like just sexualized and sold. And so basically they could, it was like really very retro feeling. And then in their ordinary lives, they're, you know, they're feminists and they realize how much sexism is in the world. And there's just this huge contrast between the way they're being treated by the company and the way they want to be treated as women in the world.
And how are they able to start winning some of these battles over, you know, weight, age, pregnancy, all of the things that were getting them fired, you know, that they were fighting against?
Well, I will say that the weight battle has never really been fully resolved to everybody's satisfaction. There are still some weight limits for flight attendants, more commonly on airlines outside the United States, but still in the United States too. Sometimes it's been replaced by a performance test, but the weight issue is not gone. So they're still kind of fighting that battle. But back in the 60s, they filed a lot of complaints with the EEOC, and flight attendants are really some of the first people to realize that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, preventing sex discrimination in employment, could really be wielded as like a real tool against the companies they were working for. And they filed lawsuits, tons of complaints. There were hearings when the airlines were trying to keep men off the plane and, you know, saying that, oh, only women could work this job, and all these restrictions on women's, you know, appearance were necessary for the performance of the job. And then, yeah, they put pressure on their unions to bring up these issues and to fight with the company over them. So it was like a multi-pronged approach.
Well, I mean, I think it's really significant that they are among the first workers to really use Title VII, right? That you know, I mean, I think when the Civil Rights Act is written, yeah, Title VII is in there, but, you know, issues around women were not really taken very seriously, including by the EEOC in its early years. And, you know, these women are really forcing the question on a somewhat recalcitrant government. And so, you know, to me, that's the role of the government here is a really big part of the story. And, you know, can you talk a little bit more about the ways in which they're able to leverage power within the government or against the government to force the change?
I do think that force is really the operative word here. Like, they were really pushing this in a way that nobody expected them to or wanted them to. The EEOC was set up, I mean, explicitly to deal with race. And nobody thought that it was going to be full of, like, you know, these very skinny white women coming in and complaining about, you know, being discriminated against. It was not expected. And a sort of a third major character in my story is this woman, Sonia Pressman, who is the first woman lawyer in the general counsel's office at the EEOC. And she could see these complaints coming in, like hundreds of them stacking up from stewardesses. This is in the mid 60s, complaining about the working conditions and, you know, the sexism at their airlines, and saying that, like, now this is illegal. Now that we have the Civil Rights Act, this is illegal. And no one at the EEOC was paying attention. They were like, no, we had to deal with race. These complaints all went to the bottom of the file. And Sonia basically, she did her own sort of forcing. You know, she basically complained enough and brought them to be enough people's attention that they started actually, the EEOC was forced to take a little action in favor of the stewardesses. Another government supporter was Martha Griffiths. She was a huge supporter of the stewardesses, made a lot of speeches and wrote a lot of strongly worded letters to airline executives asking if they were running, you know, an airline or a whorehouse. That was her famous line.
And you know, I mean, it seemed like as well that their cases were so egregious that, you know, when these decisions were handed down, it was often people you didn't expect who were willing to go along with them. I mean, you tell, I don't want to give away the story because I don't want you to tell it, but you tell this one story about a case that goes up before three really like iconic figures in the American judicial system, you know, two of whom are known extreme conservatives and one who is a liberal icon, right? And you know, that to me is like a fascinating little vignette. And I was wondering if you'd share that.
Sure. Yeah, that was a case that was brought by Mary Pat Laffey, who was a flight attendant who wanted to be a purser. And purser was basically, it's like a glorified flight attendant. There are a few more responsibilities, but the work is more or less the same and the pay is much higher. And those roles went to men almost exclusively. And Mary Pat was working for Northwest, and Northwest was doing everything it could to avoid giving her the job of purser. I mean, they made her take a test. Actually, they invented a test just for her to take. And they, you know, once she finally passed the test and she got the highest score, she was put on like the bottom of the seniority list. And if you know anything about being a flight attendant, seniority is everything. It's how you get the flights that you want. It's how you set your schedule. It's about pay. It's everything. And she basically, they made her jump through these ridiculous hoops in order to get a job as a purser. And finally, she had enough and she filed a lawsuit. And the lawsuit goes through for decades, for many years. And it does end up in front of three justices, one of whom is Robert Bork, famous conservative, and one of whom is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so the case is being argued, and that there was one other conservative justice whose name is now escaping me. Do you remember her?
It's Ken Starr.
Ken Starr, right. That was it. Ken
Starr, right. Everyone's favorite guy.
Right, exactly. And so her lawyer, Mike Gottsman, is arguing this case. And I think it was Bork who comes in and says, like, you know, this is, it was basically, he makes a statement to the effect of, the Northwest's behavior has been so egregious that, like, he's already convinced that Mary Pat is in the right and that there's just no way that Northwest could continue to pretend that they were avoiding giving her the job for anything other than the fact that she was a woman.
Too offensive for Robert Bork is quite a standard. I mean, you know, that's a bar that's rarely reached.
I mean, and when Mike was telling me that story, to the lawyer for Mary Pat, he was terrified at the idea of going up in front of Ken Starr and Robert Bork. Like, he knew that Ginsburg would be on his side, but he was sure that these other two would find a way to say, like, oh no, Northwest behavior is fine, and, you know, only men should be pursers. But it was their behavior was so outrageous that even they were convinced. So an unlikely win, I would say.
Indeed. And yes. Yeah. So, you know, what about, you know, it, you know, in the early years of your book, you know, we're talking about a almost exclusively white workforce, right? By the 70s, this begins to change. And can you talk about the experiences of Black attendants and other women of color in this job?
Yeah, it was pretty dispiriting to learn about. And I was trying very, very hard to find more flight attendants of color who could speak to being in the union, because my story really is about, you know, labor and this sort of huge sea change in union representation. But they basically, you know, turns out that unions are as about as, you know, racially friendly or as everybody else. And they, a lot of them felt that they weren't welcome there. There was a big push in the late 60s that the airline started reaching out to historically Black colleges and universities trying to recruit flight attendants. And so there were some, and they trickled onto the plane very, very slowly. I interviewed Joan Dorsey, who was the first Black flight attendant at American Airlines. And she basically was reluctant to complain. You know, she was, had basically known that, like, to keep her job and to get along, you know, it was not good to badmouth the company. But I had talked to some other flight attendants who started in the 70s, and they were much more forthcoming about how difficult it was to be a Black flight attendant and how it still is difficult, honestly. Some of them have told me that even in recent years, the racism from passengers is getting worse. And one of them was on the plane recently and somebody airdropped her, you know, using an iPhone, like airdropped her a photo of like a noose. And I was just horrified. I mean, so it's a hard time to be a flight attendant right now in particular, but as always, it's much harder for the Black women.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is a good time, you know, here in the last few minutes to move toward the present. You know, that, as you point out, it is a hard time to be a flight attendant. And, you know, behavior on airlines has become notorious in the last couple of years with masking and, you know, the rise of violence on airlines and air, you know, flight attendants getting hurt and getting punched and losing teeth and things like this. And, you know, so can you talk a little bit about the legacy of these pioneering women you discuss in sort of the ways in which flight attendants are fighting back against the problems they face in the workplace today?
Sure. Well, I feel like you can kind of see the legacy of what I like to think of as my flight attendants. Every time you get on a plane and you see a woman working who is, you know, in her 40s or her 50s or is not a size 2, you know, you can, that's like right in front of you, or if somebody shows you a picture of her kids or grandkids, like that could not have happened 50 years ago. So that kind of legacy is there. But basically, as if you look back on it, even when you think about the 1993 strike, there was a big strike by American Airlines flight attendants around Thanksgiving. Something had to be resolved by Bill Clinton, and Time magazine called flight attendants like the new face of labor. But I think there's absolutely a through line from when my story starts in the 60s to even what we have right now with Sarah Nelson out there, you know, fighting the good fight for not just flight attendants, but for workers in general. There's a good through line and a case to argue that flight attendants have always been the face of labor. Like they have always been there. And the fact that they have been overlooked for so long, I think, can be put down to the fact that, you know, A, they're women, and B, the contrast between what people expect of a flight attendant, like smiling, docile, friendly, pretty, is not always, and the behavior of labor leaders is not always considered something that can be reconciled. But I do feel like, especially right now, when we look towards the union drive at Delta and the things that are going on, like there is absolutely a, and if Sarah Nelson becomes the next president of the AFL-CIO, and like that would be, you know, huge. And if the president of the AFL-CIO is a flight attendant, I think that just goes to show like really how important they've been to the labor movement.
Yeah. I mean, it is telling that the, you know, Liz Shuler may be the contemporary president of the AFL-CIO, but Sarah Nelson is clearly the labor leader in this country that has inspired the most people in the last many years. I mean, arguably last few decades. And so, you know, it is telling that, at least in a kind of moral sense, that the flight attendants are the leaders of the contemporary labor movement. I think you could make a very good argument for that. And I guess, you know, to close, my last question for you, because I don't think probably our listeners know too much about this. Could you talk a little bit about what's going on at Delta?
Sure. Delta is the second largest airline in the United States, and its flight attendants have never been unionized. And I think there are 24,000 flight attendants working for Delta right now, which is huge. And the Association of Flight Attendants, which is the organization of which Sarah Nelson is president, they have tried three times to organize the flight attendants at Delta. And right now they're in the middle of maybe not the final push. We can hope it's the final push, but they're trying very hard to organize those flight attendants and to bring them into the Association of Flight Attendants. And Delta it's not shy about, you know, saying that it's anti-union. They're employing traditional union busting methods. And of course, COVID has sort of like, you know, put a wrench in the works of trying to get people to sign cards, because when people need to sign cards in person, you can't organize people virtually or over Zoom. But there's definitely a giant push going on right now, and you can you can Google it if you want, but there's a lot of reasons I think that Delta flight attendants might be willing to finally join the AFA this time around, not least of which is, as you pointed out, Eric, the current behavior of passengers on airplanes and the difficulties of being a flight attendant right now. And, you know, people coming to work sick and, you know, COVID taking out workers and people having to work long shifts, never mind having like being groped by passengers or punched by passengers or, you know, having to resort to, like in the case of Frontier Airlines, duct taping a passenger to his seat because he was so badly behaved.
Yeah. Well, Nell, we want to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been, speaking to Nell McShane-Wolfhart about her brand new book, The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. Nell, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Eric. This was so much fun.
And we'll be back soon with another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,